Hey friends, it's me again, Shane. I just want to tell you again about our beloved sponsor, Compassion International. Most of you probably know Compassion is a sponsorship program. They help kids in poverty all around the world escape that poverty through one-on-one sponsorship. It's a fantastic program. Kate and I have been a sponsor for years now. Just because of my recent proximity to Compassion, I've gotten to hear awesome stories. Some of those stories about people who have been able to reconnect with adults who were kids that they used to sponsor. And oftentimes, not only does that kid know who that person was and remember them, they've kept their letters throughout the years because they meant so much to them. That's what this means to those kids. I got to see that firsthand in Sri Lanka. And if you haven't, go back and listen to episode 156, where I talk about my recent trip to Sri Lanka. Compassion is the world's leading authority in holistic child development through sponsorship. They're releasing children from poverty in Jesus' name. Listen, you don't need a politician's permission to do good in the world, to bring about justice and reconciliation. If you want to find out more, go to compassion.com/dropout. It's compassion.com/dropout. You can look for links in the show notes to the show as well. You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is David P. Leong. David is an associate professor of missiology at Seattle Pacific University and Seminary, where he also serves as the director of the Global and Urban Ministry Minor. He previously served in churches in urban Seattle through ministries focused on community groups and neighborhood involvement. His new book is called Race and Place: How Urban Geography Shapes the Journey of Reconciliation. David, thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's my privilege.
You made a comment early in the book about, you know, something about why we need another book on race. There are a lot of them, but I don't really get tired of them. But I wonder what you thought you had to bring to the table that hadn't been said before.
Well, I'll that's a good question. I will make no claims to originality or real. On the one hand, I think that I'm taking the conversation to a particular place intentionally, but at the same time, I think it'd be disingenuous for me to say, I've broken ground in a way that no one has ever thought of before. I think anyone who reads a lot knows that there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of interconnection between material. And I think in some ways, I feel like I'm in between disciplines and in between worlds. And so I talk to urban planners and geographers, and my wife is a real estate agent. And I think I just feel like I'm sometimes just translating things and thinking about a conversation from two different points. And so that's what I was trying to do in the book, is just, in the world of urban ethnography and urban anthropology and urban planning, like the idea that space is racialized, or that race and place, like that's the most unoriginal idea. So what, if anything, is unique, then I think it's maybe just trying to bring that conversation into the church and trying to bring it before thoughtful Christians and students, to say, like, have we been missing, this conversation that actually has been going on in some corners for some time? But does it bring a new dynamic to thinking about race in geographic terms, or in the more sort of mundane context of, street corners and neighborhoods and so forth?
In addition to this idea that geography is shaped by race, or where people live is often shaped by race, but it also shapes the way that we look at race. Like, one's perspective on race often depends on the kind of environment in which they grew up.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think, the funny thing about, if you wanted to call it like culture, this isn't really a thing, I'm just off the top of my head here, there is a sort of cultural geographic discourse in the United States. It's not something explicit. That's more of like an academic way of thinking about it. But the way people think, I guess what I mean by that is saying the way people think about place in the U.S. Oftentimes it has to do with social class. And people who are well-educated or people who are upwardly mobile, they really don't have to think about place by necessity. It's more of they imagine themselves, and I might even put myself in this category at times, as saying that we imagine ourselves living above place. Like place is something that we can choose to live somewhere, or we can choose to move somewhere, or we can like a place or not like a place, and we can go to the places that we like and avoid the places we don't like. And it's sort of part of our consumptive world. But for those who don't have some of those class signifiers, who may not be as well educated, who may not have some of the mobility, place is just like the most common. It's like the most common, like the lowest common denominator of social existence, like interacting with the necessity of place and how it shapes our social environment is just like the most basic fundamental reality. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think it's for me, thinking about place is sometimes an academic exercise, but then I realize, like, for many people in the world, attachment to place and the way that place shapes our social and racial imagination is just as fundamental as anything else.
Well, I think, and, you know, correct me if this is not the same thing that you're saying, but a tangible thing that I think most people can relate to is that the idea of a red state or a blue state, like, isn't it funny that all people that happen to be born, you know, in certain parts of the South happen to lean conservative, and, you know, vice versa for some places in the Northeast or the Northwest?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, now that we're in the age of, I mean, we have been for some time, but in sort of advanced analytics, you know, big data is what drives everything these days. And I'm in Seattle, just a city that the tech industry is just, it's all about data all the time. But it just makes me think of how demographers can, you know, take your zip code and, you know, with very minimal points of data, with maybe your zip code and a little bit more about you, they can actually determine quite a bit. You know, they can guess with a fair degree of certainty, you know, your education level, your social class, down to some of your consumer, you know, preferences, just based on your location. You know, are you in a city? Are you in a first ring suburb? Are you in a rural area? Are you in, you know, a Midwestern state? And that's a reality. You know, it's a marketing reality, but I think more significantly, it's, you know, geography shapes all of our lives, all of our, from our everyday consumptive habits to kind of what our worshiping communities look like, what our public schools and street corners look like. Absolutely. It reminds me of a book that I, you know, came to a bit late that I wish I would have read more closely before I published, before I finished Race and Place. And it's called The Big Sort. And it really just describes this kind of sorting of American society into these geographic pockets of homogeneity. And I think it's always been the case to a degree, but but the degree to which we are increasingly in these culturally, socially, economically, and racially homogeneous pockets is quite alarming.
Growing up, you lived in several cities. You kind of moved around a lot.
Yeah, I think that maybe somewhere, you know, my interest in place probably comes from having moved around a lot. I was having coffee with my wife yesterday, and I was joking with her that it's like taken me most of my adult life to realize, now that I have kids of my own, like, moving around a lot was not normal. Like, we moved a ton, and you know, I ask my parents about it to this day, that they don't have a very good answer, except for, you know, I think it was a lot of my dad was an entrepreneur. He moved around a lot, and apparently just felt like that was, I don't know, just looking for new opportunities. But I was born in Detroit, and so my kind of roots, my parents were born there as well. So I have a couple generations going back in the Detroit area. But I actually grew up in North Carolina, but in a few different cities. I lived in Charlotte and in Raleigh through most of my childhood. So I grew up in the South. And then after around kind of elementary school age, we moved out to California. So I moved to the West Coast, and then eventually up to the Pacific Northwest for high school and college. So I've I've been around a little bit, at least in terms of, you know, spending a lot of the formative years. They were not just in one place. It's kind of an odd, to me, I can follow the path of our travels, but the places weren't necessarily related. You know, they were just, there's more backstory there, but
sure. It wasn't like your dad was in the military or even with the,
no,
sound
no.
like even like a single company that just transferred him. Like he was just an entrepreneur.
Yeah, basically.
How do you think, other than not realizing that that wasn't normal, how do you think that affected you?
Well, I think it's given me, at the very least, some very formative memories of different types of places. And sometimes you don't appreciate them until, you know, it's much later down the road. But I think back, and I made, you know, a very brief mention of this in the beginning of the book, like I have really fond memories of growing up in the South. Like, it's a different conversation, you know, when we talk about racial identity formation, a lot of that happens post-adolescence. And so I joke in the book that, you know, I didn't even realize that we were Chinese. I remember there was this one, I don't think this is in the book, but I remember this one time we went to the state fair, the North Carolina State Fair, and it was in Raleigh. And I can only vaguely recall the details, but I think someone was yelling at us. I think some folks were, I was pretty little, and they were yelling like, "Go back to where you came from." And I remember asking my parents about it later, thinking like, being sort of confused, like they want us to go back to Michigan. I was like, what's with that? You know, I didn't really get it. And now I'm forgetting what the original question was, but North Carolina was just a great place to grow up. You know, I think I played with all the kids on the street. It was just so many fond memories of these warm, humid late summers of, you know, sitting in the cul-de-sac with the kids, you know, sipping on lemonade and playing hide and seek and, you know, barbecues at the park. And, I have really fond memories of that, even though as I've come to late, now that my kids are that age, are elementary school age, now I think about like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I think back around, you know, the long commute that I took from where we were living to, I was bused into the city to be at a more diverse elementary school. So just things like that that look different based on where I am now. I spent all my adult life in the Pacific Northwest. So I don't know. I think I have at the very least different types of contexts to think about and to weigh in terms of how they shape people's life experiences.
So, you know, I think about my upbringing. So I grew up in a smallish town in West Texas, about 25,000 people or so. It was not really close to anything. I mean, Dallas, so it's on the same interstate as Dallas, but about 5 hours east. And the next town on the other side that anybody would know about is Midland, Texas, and not even a lot of people know about that.
Uh-huh. But
that was about an hour east of us. So we're kind of in the middle of nowhere, town of 25,000 people. So it's not like a farming community, but pretty small. I wonder just with those details, what you think, how that would affect someone's view of the world and specifically ideas of race.
Oh, man. That's so complicated. No, I appreciate that, that bit of context. I think it's hard to separate some of these reflections with kind of in the wake of the election. It's just, you know, sure. I'm realizing, I think I've known for some time that, hey, like I've been in Seattle since 90s, you know, gosh, like, is that right? Almost 20 years, give or take a couple for grad school, I traveled some, but, and I think I've been living in this big blue city, this like bubble of a blue city, a Pacific Rim city, a tech city, a fast growing and dynamic and, you know, multicultural city in some ways. And even though I've lived and experienced other places, I think, wow, I've spent, you know, my most formative, you know, all my adult years here, and it's beginning to kind of distort my sense of reality.
Sure.
And so even though as an academic, you know, I do research on cities around the world, I think it's what's striking to me as an urbanist is that I begin to, you know, I think about the transnational nature of cities. And so I might actually have like my day-to-day living might be more similar to international cities like in other countries than a very different, you know, this sort of small town experience that you're describing in Texas, that may be a very different kind of life than, it, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, that, no, absolutely.
So I think when it comes to, you know, small town America, I think there's not a lot to rehash that hasn't been, you know, exhausted in the news in these last few weeks. But at the same time, I think that it totally makes sense. You know, I think when I think back to the community that I grew up in North Carolina, I realize now that my family being Chinese, but also third generation Chinese American, was somewhat of a novelty to a lot of people that we met. And so I get that, you know, I wouldn't have expected them, to know what a microaggression is, you know, when they ask me like, no, where are you really from? You know, I wouldn't expect people to get that. I know that our family was like an outlier to them. And in the end, it wasn't an obstacle to us forming like meaningful relationships. We were deeply involved in the neighborhood and in a church, and we were the only Asians from what I can remember. So I don't know. I guess it's a bigger question, but I recognize more and more that part of our we really have to personalize some of the racial discourse in our country is so broken that we really need to find places to engage with people interpersonally, and that's just much more difficult to do in a place where there isn't. Where there isn't that level, where maybe there are not those practical opportunities to engage with someone on that level.
I've just noticed how vitally important, almost without exception, our upbringing, the geography specifically, the impact that has on the way we think about things and the way, and race specifically. You know, I think of like, I don't know if you've read Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, but just this idea that we think that this greatness comes out of nowhere, or anything, it just comes out of nowhere, like it comes from a vacuum, but that the place that we grew up has a very, very, it plays a really prominent role.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite books that I use, I've been using for years in undergraduate classes, just for having very introductory conversations about race, is Beverly Daniel Tatum's Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And she's a developmental psychologist. And she really talks about, and that's why there's a couple stories in the book about my own kids. You know, I realize now as an adult that racial identity formation, begins very early. And it happens a little bit. It's different for everyone. I think that, not every individual and every family kind of has its own unique, DNA and different cultures and habits and practices and postures. But at the same time, no, I totally agree that it starts early, and our earliest conceptions of people and, you know, who's friendly and who's not, who's welcome and who's not, who is, you know, part of our social in-group and who is not. Those things are largely tacit. You know, they're not really ever spelled out. They're often, things that we just sort of absorb around us. And it's not until we have those encounters or experiences with an outsider, quote unquote, and maybe that's in adolescence or in early adulthood, when those real differences, you know, we're not really made aware of those things that have been implicit to us for so long until that occurs. And then we have this disruptive moment, right, where we realize like, oh, I didn't even know that was a part of me. But it's all in there. I think that's the scary part is, we like to think of ourselves as all, thoughtful, kind individuals. But I think that's why, I make a brief reference to the book Blind Spot, the popular book that published a lot of Harvard's implicit association testing research. And I just think if there's anything we take away from that, it's just that, man, we are just loaded up with all of these implicit biases that rarely surface until we have one of those moments, and then we realize like, wow, where did that come from? Or where does this kind of deep rooted suspicion or fear, what is that about? And I think sometimes it can be traced to things in, you know, that are embedded really early on.
So let's talk about some specifics of the way that geography and the physical space around us is used to divide and has an impact on race. You talk specifically about the program in the 1950s in America to build out what we know today as our highway systems.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the racial impacts of that.
Oh man, how much time do we have? It's funny, again, this is not unique research at all. It's, you know, it's just me reading urban geography and urban anthropology and just recognizing that freeways, the creation of, you know, tens of thousands of miles of concrete highways across the country and around our cities and beltways and interstate highways, all of it, that this really reshaped the American landscape in ways that we're still wrestling with right now. I mean, in ways that really no one could have foreseen. I mean, the great irony is the motivation behind highways was really national defense. You know, it was just a way to move, you know, military forces around in the event that we were ever, you know, faced with a land invasion after World War II. And the great irony is it becomes one of the, you know, the biggest public works investment at the time in the country, but it has kind of an unintended alternative effect, and it makes cars, you know, central to our way of life and to transportation. But specifically what it does in cities is it really racializes cities unintentionally by providing a quick outlet, and it just lays the foundation for what becomes suburbia. And I think I mentioned this in the book that, you know, I grew up in the suburbs. I'm a product of a, you know, kind of suburban, kind of an idyllic suburban neighborhood and a good education. But it really just wasn't until I learned these things as a college student, like, wow, that was that the creation of freeways and thereby, and I'm skipping a lot of steps here for the sake of time, but what eventually becomes suburbia, right? These communities that are outside of cities, but that are convenient and quickly accessible by car, that was really, that forever racialized the landscape of the United States. And I think there's more to it, a lot of it having to do with housing policy. But I don't think I could, I mean, that's a pretty central piece in the second part of the book. I don't think I could overstate how much those geographic factors are still at play in some of the tensions in segregated public schools, in what our PTAs and Boy Scout troops look like, and what our churches look like. So I just feel like that's one of the primary geographic realities I think about in the book is, man, how do we overcome these huge structural barriers?
You know, I think it's so hard for almost everyone who's alive right now to kind of wrap our heads around what life was like before suburbs. But I, you know, my understanding is that there was much more of a mix of houses, apartments, duplexes, townhomes, mixed in with small grocery stores, shops, general stores.
So
it's easy to imagine that once, you know, the advent of the suburb happens after these highways are built, well, who can go there? Well, one, you have to have a car.
Yeah, I mean, the bigger piece, though, even beyond, you know, the accessibility of an automobile from a, like, an economic standpoint, the bigger piece, and, you know, I get at this a bit in the book, was really just that the creation of the single family suburban home was the engine of an economy of boomers that really just accelerated economic growth and mobility in the country. But the real key was that it was, from a legal standpoint, from a policy standpoint, it was a racially exclusive consumer good. Like, those homes that were built in the suburbs that would become the financial foundation of middle-class Americans for decades were not available, were only sold to white families, you know, with the exclusion of, like, maybe 1% of, you know, the mortgages. And so there's, and I try to unpack this in the book, and there's not the space, there's a lot of other, you know, there's footnotes you can look at that talk about the creation of the Federal Housing Administration and the mortgage industry and the whole process. But really, it's that explicit legal racial exclusivity in the creation of those suburban homes that really just that created the wealth gap, and we're still dealing with that. And I think it's been just exacerbated since the Great Recession. But I think, you know, we're talking about a consumer good, and so an economic, piece to move up the ladder. But equally important is kind of the symbolism, a way of life that came with it. And so I think all of those things, you know, came with the suburbs, a different way of life, but also a very, you know, explicit legal and racial exclusion of an enormous part of the U.S. But, sometimes, you know, maybe we have a dream of American suburbia, and we may wonder why it looked that way, why it looked so homogeneous. And I think there were legal reasons why. And so it's weird. I think maybe because I've thought about this so much, I still have difficulty thinking about the suburbs, because they're just built on such an ugly history. Mm-hmm. Of course, the irony being that with gentrification, there's now a sort of reversal happening, and we're seeing more and more diversity in the suburbs, and more, it's just kind of people trading places, but anyhow.
Yeah. And poverty in the suburbs as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, it's kind of the great irony. And I call it, you know, there's a sort of return flight, you know, from the burbs back into cities now. And that's, you know, you talked earlier about, you know, what it was like before suburbia. And I think we have it in those quote unquote urban traditional neighborhoods that are mixed use, you know, where we have different types of housing, there's density, there's walkability. Those are all the, you know, the key terms for gentrifying neighborhoods, right? That's what people want these days, is that, that in city, lifestyle. And I think that's the great irony, is that what was once fled is now cool again. And so there you go.
So to kind of unpack a little bit about what you're saying, to get a little more specific, through what's known as like steering, redlining, which if anybody doesn't know, Google it. These were systems that, I mean, literally living in the suburbs was not an option for 99% of people of color during that time.
Yeah. I mean, people were, I mean, the story is basically, another piece I use a lot in my classes, about a 12-year-old documentary called Race, the Power of an Illusion, but it's a 3-part documentary, and the third part is called The House I Live In. And it really just outlines this well, of saying that essentially you had a massive population of GIs, you know, veterans coming back after World War II. There was a huge demand for housing, and cities just did not have the capacity to house everybody. There was a boom in the population that, you know, and there was not space. And so the creation of suburbs was the creation of these mass-produced single-family homes that were all built after World War II. These were extremely desirable, and lots of people wanted to live that way. And actually, even, you know, there are plenty of communities of color, of middle-class immigrants and whatnot, who wanted to buy these homes, but they were literally excluded. They were told essentially, like, well, we can't sell to you. The developers, and a lot of it is just the financial structure, the underwriters who were subsidizing this was the U.S. government. The U.S. government was backing all of these loans. And this was a social experiment on a massive scale. And I think the government, you know, you can blame the government. In some ways, they're just protecting their own financial interest in seeing that racial diversity was a threat to, you know, this yet undetermined long-term viability of all the, you know, if the U.S. government is dumping billions of dollars into a mortgage industry, they're going to ensure that those homes remain, you know, valuable in 30 years. And so the racial exclusion that was baked into the whole program was just kind of, it made sense. It was just extraordinarily unjust.
And the other side of that, what you were kind of hinting at, is that generally, real estate is a fantastic investment. It appreciates generally pretty well over time. And so this was a whole group of people that were not able to make that investment, to have that kind of security that white people were able to enjoy too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think anyone who's written or read about redlining has exhausted this. And I think sometimes there's a tendency to say like, oh, that was a long time ago. That was before civil rights. And, you know, fair housing passed, 50 years ago. What's the big deal now? And I think what we really underestimate is we have a myth in the United States that economic mobility is much more fluid than it actually is. And when we talk about the accumulation of wealth over time, there is no way to overstate the significance of that first generation of homeowners from essentially, 1950 to 1980. Fair housing that passed in the 60s really wasn't, was resisted in most cities well into the 1970s. I mean, so you're talking about a whole generation of folks who were given enormous wealth, and I think who were allowed to, I mean, who worked for it, but it wasn't handed to them on a silver platter per se. And people paid off those mortgages, but they were given opportunity. They were given access to low interest loans that gave them, being in real estate, the purchase of a home is the biggest investment and the most valuable asset in the financial profile of most American families. And so to have that, afforded to a large group and excluded from another is just, I can't think of a worse equation. If you're wondering about the wealth gap today, it's like, just, you can do the math. You don't have to, it's not too complicated.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the government realized, I think, that people of color had to live somewhere. So their solution was to group them in some undesirable part of the city, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the irony is they were not able to buy property except for a very, small number of people who, I mean, there would not have been points of access for families of color to purchase, land in the city. And so what happens in parallel to the development of the suburbs, which were almost without exception white, what happens in parallel at the same time is, various programs. This is the development of public housing, of subsidized housing, of basically, the projects, the ghettos, Section 8 housing. This was developed in parallel as an alternative, since families of color were not able to purchase homes, they were given these, they were given the opportunity to rent. At reduced rates, or to rent, at market rates. But we all know from, that over time, renting, you're paying off the equity of someone else. You're earning equity for someone else. You're paying off someone else's loan. You're not accumulating any wealth to pass down. And so I think it's a very clear, the contrasts are really striking, at the time, these are public policy decisions, and this is just when housing and urban development is getting started. But, when we look at the outcomes that we have now, it's no surprise if we just look and see where people were literally funneled. These were the places that you could live, and these were the options that you had, and that's what's brought us to where we currently are.
A lot of white people, although they would never say that, they look around their city now and more times than not, there's still the black side of town or something like that. And I think people just have some really backwards opinions about why that is. But what we don't realize is that, basically what you've been saying is that was very intentionally done and not done by those people's free will, but by the will of the American government.
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, in the sense that I don't want to just make the Federal Housing Administration during that era into the big bad boogeyman who's solely to blame. I think it's complex in the sense that today we look at residential segregation, and because of fair housing, we say like, well, then that's just, that we chalk it up to what we call, self-segregation. We say, well, that's where people just choose to live, with their own people. And that's legal, and that's just the way it's natural. I think what we underestimate, though, is really what urban demographers or planners would say is the the durability or resiliency of ethnic enclaves. So when we talk about, you know, why one part of the city is Asian or Black or Latino or where Indigenous people live, like that, you know, these there's a high durability to those types of affiliations. When I think of my own city in Seattle, like there's an area called the Central District, which was like the only majority Black community in a 5-state region for like almost 100 years. And you know, why is that? How did that happen? You know, what, you know, many decades after fair housing? Well, it happened basically because at one point it was the middle of nowhere, and the only place that that Blacks were allowed to buy land was like, you know, far out from the city. And so this was where they settled in like the early 1900s when Seattle was just a small town. And so like more than 100 years later, people are still living there. You know, like I think there's, so I think there is some, there is a degree to which there's much more freedom and mobility. People have more freedom and mobility now than they've ever had, but we really underestimate that, you know, the resiliency of those historic factors and how they've shaped kind of the, you know, the contemporary geography that we find ourselves in.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
I have read, I've had conversations. I'm really interested in gentrification, and yet there's still parts of it that I have a hard time wrapping my head around. And I think part of that goes back to, in some ways, it's hard, it's difficult to find the villain in the situation, because we live in a, we kind of have an attitude that in America, anybody should be able to choose to live wherever they want.
Right.
And so it's difficult to unpack. I was talking to Sean Duncan about this. He works with Bob Lupton's organization. I know you quoted Lupton a lot. And just about, you know, the difficulty, you know, often what happens is, you know, an artist just needs some space to do their work, and all they can afford is something in the lower socioeconomic neighborhood, you know? And then the dominoes kind of fall from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the chapter in the book on gentrification is I think my, I don't know if it's, I was going to say my favorite chapter. I think it's something that I enjoyed writing, but then finished thinking like it's actually one that got cut a lot too, because I started, I feel like there's another book in there somewhere. Like, I feel like I was just getting started and then I had to end the chapter because it was getting too long, because it's such a complex topic and it's so relevant for where we find ourselves. But yeah, it's true that there's not, I think like with all deeply entrenched and complex social problems, there's, it'd be easier if there was, you know, a singular bad guy that we could just point out. And, but of course there's a lot of moving parts, and this is what I try to set up in the book, is that, you know, gentrification is best understood as really a reaction. It's best seen in the context of the development of suburbia, right? I mean, a lot of what's driving it is kind of this, is a wave of folks. It's both a cultural and generational shift. And I tried to pick up on this a little bit. I don't know if you got to read the chapter on gentrification, but and the metaphor I use in the book, and I don't know if this works well or not, is sitcoms. I grew up watching, you know, all these family sitcoms in the 80s. And I talk about the shift between kind of the 1980s nuclear suburban, you know, family ties and growing pains. Like, you have the centerpiece of American life being a nuclear suburban family in the burbs. And I talk about the emergence of Friends. And, the, you know, it's funny to me when I talk to college students now, Friends is like their...
like that show that's on Nick at Night?
yeah, it's like this old show that's like a bizarre creation of the 90s to them. But to me, I remember the 90s. Like, you know, I was... So it's a symbolic shift. But I think what you see is, you know, a move away from a fixation with the nuclear suburban traditional family, and into a kind of saying a form of new urbanism, right? A sort of urban aesthetic, a lifestyle of New York, of cafe living, of singles, of kind of you know. And I think so what I tried to get at in the gentrification chapter is, without looking at the policy mechanics and some of the economic pieces, all of which are important, I really tried to focus on this idea of aesthetics, that gentrification is driven by a sort of lifestyle aesthetic, like a way of being and consuming and living. And I think that's to me one of the things that I'm still working on and trying to understand, say, what does it mean? Because like you said, that artist had really good intentions. That art, my wife is an artist. Yeah. She was an art major at the University of Oregon, and she's an abstract painter, and you know, she paints because it's part of who I believe God created her to be. She loves to create, and you know,
it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing. But what happens in between that artist and like a neighborhood becoming cool? Mm. Like, there's a lot of little things that take place, and that's what I want to focus on. And I'm not sure how to do that, because it's not a technical process. It's like an aesthetic process, right? Where you know, where one store changes and we notice who's there and how it's designed, and all of us are, I think, are tacitly consuming these things daily. Like, you know, we're reading fonts, and we're looking at you know, how a space feels, and we're feeling like, this is kind of a cool place, or this is a place for me. And I think that's, to me, what is driving gentrification more than, I mean, again, not to say that the economics aren't important. I think that's, but to me, it's, I don't know, at least for the sake of the book, what I chose to focus on was the aesthetics of cool, to say, like, you know, how is that the engine of gentrification in a lot of ways that we're not exploring?
It seems like what you're saying is that a lot of things are hard, if not, one, impossible to legislate. Like, you can't say, if you're a restaurant in this neighborhood, you can't use Helvetica font on your sign.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Times New Roman only.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You're not allowed to serve pork belly here or any charcuterie. Yeah. But I think that also presents a beautiful opportunity for the church as well, because it kind of sounds like what you're saying, like, these are personal choices, personal decisions. They're like matters of the heart.
Yeah, I think something I try to go after, and I don't know if it's done very well in the book or not, but I try to kind of, you know, tease out what it is that motivates this cool Christianity, you know, for lack of a better term. I think that it would be a number of, you know, you could point to a huge library of books around Christianity's relationship with popular and contemporary culture and the various types of modes, to use Andy Crouch's language, like the postures and gestures that Christians take with popular culture. But I, you know, what I'm trying to get at in the chapter on gentrification is really just saying, you know, what does what's happening below the surface that makes us desire these things that we believe to be cool, you know, like, and I think, I don't think it's an explicit process. I don't think people are waking up and saying, like, I'm going to put these jeans on and, you know, grow my facial hair in a way that,
yeah,
you know, in a way that projects this image. But I think it's more, it's just, I think we talked earlier about these bubbles or these pockets of homogeneity. It's just so part of our presupposed world. Like, why wouldn't you why wouldn't you eat this? This is delicious, and everyone should eat this. I think I don't know where I'm going with this, except to say that I think these are the questions that need to be interrogated a little bit more closely, to say, like, what are the actual outcomes when we kind of get together and say, like, this is good music. Like, this is how a restaurant should run. This is what housing should look like. This is what, you know, these are the types of stores we desire. I think that there's a point at which those aesthetic inclinations begin to perpetuate this, you know, the theme in the book, the second part of the book, I just call it patterns of exclusion. I think there's this pattern of exclusion that keeps recurring, and I think it's very dangerous.
So I wonder, in all these things that we're talking about, what does redemption and what does reconciliation look like? I mean, specifically for gentrification, I think some of us kind of feel like there's no good answer, because it's either, we feel like either our choices are segregation or gentrification, right?
Right, right.
And honestly, that's something that I've really wrestled with. I've done a lot of wrestling with what the question of what does it mean for me to live in this neighborhood and not be a positive thing?
No, I think this is kind of the heart of the conversation. And so I appreciate the question. It's complicated, and I'm not sure where to begin. I think there's, in the book, I really, I talk about how in some ways the language of reconciliation is premature. And I think I was hesitant in some ways to even use it, because in part, sometimes reconciliation presumes too much, in the sense that, we want to get there too early. We want to fix the problems and feel better. And we don't want to, I think you mentioned Sim Chan Ra earlier. I think, sometimes reconciliation, our eagerness to get there, makes us want to leapfrog over lament, and I don't want to do that. So I think the lament, in gentrification, there's much to lament, and I think we need to really pause and make space for that, even as we're living our lives. And so what that looks like is difficult. I think sometimes I think there are people who are, we don't have the option of cleanly disassociating from some of the problems that we may even be contributing to. But I don't think that means that we can't be sincere and genuine in our desire to reach out and to listen and to say, like, hey, I may be contributing to a problem here, and I want to hear from you, some of your hurt, what's been lost in this community. And what can I do to preserve it? What can I do to hear you and to see you and to say that legacy, that memory, that heritage is vital and it's beautiful and it's a part of this place, and I want to preserve it. I don't want to destroy it. Mm. I think even people who are in the midst of even, like contributing to those problems can still ask that question very genuinely if they intend to act on it.
Sure.
So I think there's always potential. I don't think that anyone ever gets a pass. I think even people who would like to say, like, well, I'm just going to opt for segregation and stay out of those gentrifying places, I think they're still a part of the same kind of macro urban economy. And so they might be a degree removed from directly displacing someone. But with that said, your initial question was more about kind of what are the redemptive kind of hopes or the places that we begin to pick up the pieces.
That's right.
One thing that I'm hopeful for is that communities of folks who recognize that there's a problem, who would say, like, maybe not everyone should live in a community with a Whole Foods and a Trader Joe's and a $5 latte. Like, I think if people can get on the same page and say, like, there's perhaps an unsustainability, like, to that lifestyle, and it's not just unsustainable, it's inaccessible to many. Mm. I think if we can get on the same page there, then I think we can begin to brainstorm the ways we're living, residentially, vocationally, socially. And I talk about that in the book, of how, like, thinking about location is not just geography. Geography is a big piece, but there's also that, social and vocational piece. And so it's not just where your address is. I think there are ways in which our daily work, the relationships that we form, those have a geographic impact as well. And so I really think that the church needs to embrace this, instead of pursuing what's pragmatic and what's cool and what works and what grows, I'm really hopeful that the church would be a little bit more weird. The church would be a little bit more of a place where confusion and disruption and kind of an oddity of people together that don't belong together, like, can begin to kind of make puzzled expressions, saying, like, what are we doing here? And I think that that can be a generative space, a constructive space. I don't think. And so there's some examples in the book. I talk about communities, and one of those churches being my own, a church that's just trying to be faithful to a neighborhood, and saying, like, this neighborhood's changing, but we want to be a place where really all people are welcome. And I think this is the hardest thing. Everyone presumes that they're hospitable. Mm. I've never met a pastor or a church where people say, like, oh yeah, we're totally not welcoming. I think everyone wants to be welcoming. But the problem is that a lot of people assess their hospitality from the inside. You know, they say like, I look sure. at you and you seem like a nice person, and that's, you know, Bob's friendly and Betty's friendly too. Who wouldn't find us to be a welcoming people? And I think that that's a real challenge. I think that the measure of a church's hospitality should be its neighbors, right? Should be it's the actual people who are around. They should be the ones saying like, this is a welcoming place where I can belong. And so I think churches could be a lot more intentional about making space, about using their buildings, about using the space that they have to say, how could we be a gathering point to bring together people who don't normally gather? Immigrants, refugees, working class folks, educated folks, people from different, you know, age and ethnic groups, people with different abilities. So I think that the church, in a sense, has always done that to a degree, and basically just needs to recapture some of that original DNA of saying that the church was, you know, where I use this quote in the book a lot. It's from Stanley Hauerwas, who's quoting Bart, but anyway, he basically just says that, you know, the church is a place where God's forming a family out of strangers. And that's why I titled the third part of the book, you know, A Strange Family. It's that's my practical ecclesiology to a degree, is saying like, how can the church embrace its strangeness in the sense that it's a place where people belong to each other, where there's, where they shouldn't, right? Where in the eyes of the world, people shouldn't belong, but the church is the one place, like that's to me the litmus test for like the social ecclesia, like the faithfulness of the church's lived witness is this a place where people are belonging for no other reason except that they have a kind of common identity in Christ, that somehow by the work of the Spirit, people are being reconciled. And that's a really hard, I mean, it's a really hard thing to do. It's not something that happens overnight, but that does make me hopeful. And I think it is possible. I see communities who are moving in that direction all the time.
Well, David, it means so much that you took the time to come on Seminary Dropout. Thanks for talking.
Yeah, this was fun. I hope we can keep in touch in some way, and I've appreciated the conversation.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,